What is up, everybody? How you doing? Everybody excited to be here? All right. Hey, everybody, thank Kevin real quick. Kevin, thank you for the TV, man. Awesome. Hey, my name is Nathan. It's so good to be here. Hey, before I start, though, I want to just thank every volunteer. We don't do this enough, but here at Revolution, we don't want to build stages and platforms. We want to be a community that is building servanthood. We have so many people who serve, from the greeters to children, people behind the scenes. So can we give all our volunteers a round of applause, right? Awesome. Thank you, guys. Every one of you who serve in any way, whether it's every week or once a month, you are appreciated. But hey, we're on this series called Alive and Free, killing the things in our life that are killing us. And we said this, that we have things in our life that we don't like to talk about that may be killing us. We may realize it, we may not, but we're trying to kill those, and we want to do something. We want to be more alive and free than ever before. We want to be able to kill the things that are killing us. And so what we're looking at is like, hey, what do we need to kill in life? What do we need to kill to be more alive and free than ever before? And what I love about Revolution is every week we're a community that we say we're imperfect, but we're trying to pursue a perfect Savior. And people come to me and say, Nathan, listen, I'm killing addiction. I'm killing anxiety. I'm killing sin. I'm killing the things that are killing me. And so the series is, as individuals, how do we kill these things? But more importantly, how do we welcome people into a community that is going to teach them to live alive and free while we're all in the process of killing certain things in our life that keep us from the life that Jesus has for us, the life to be more live and free than ever before. And that's what we're going to roll with today. So let me start telling you about a race. I know that's exciting, but this is called the Race Across America. It goes across 12 states, 3 mountain ranges, and it's a cycling race. Anybody want to sign up for it? Right? It's awesome. It's the toughest, they say, I don't know, they say it's the toughest endurance race in the world. Because it's different than other endurance races like the Tour de France or other ones where they have time kind of slots where they race, they stop, they race, they stop. Well, in this race, you start in Maryland and the clock starts right away and it's clicking 24 hours a day until you get to Oceanside, California. Now, I would never sign up for this, okay? Like, doesn't that sound fun? I'm going to admit, right? I'm from Illinois, and now we live in Indiana. Both of those states are very boring, right? A lot of boringness. But have you ever driven through Kansas? It's boring in a car. I can't imagine how boring it is on a bicycle. And so cyclists are like, it's like a great accomplishment. If you finish this race, it's something to brag about. A lot of people try it. A lot of people don't finish. You know, you got to have the lung capacity, your body. You got to learn how to adjust when to sleep and not to sleep. There's a lot of things that go into the process of winning. And you just want to try to survive to the end. But something happens to riders. It's wild. It's called Schirmer's neck. Ever heard of Schirmer's neck? It's when you're riding so long and on a bicycle, you're keeping your head up. Well, you're so exhausted and so sleep deprived, you don't have enough food, where the muscles in your neck start to wear out. And so you can no longer keep your head up. A lot of people at that point quit, which I would be like, bro, I'm out of here. I can't keep my head up. I'm not pedaling anymore, right? But then there's some brave people like this. They create contraptions where they have to keep their head up. I'm like, bro, it's only a cycle race. It's not worth it, dude, right? And they do this, and they keep going. And I don't know what race this is from, but I found this dude on Google. I'm sure he appreciates the picture up here. But it's like they can't keep their neck up. And what happens is their inability to keep their neck up keeps them from what? Moving forward. Right? Unless you create a contraption like this, which I'm not signing up for that. Today, I want to look at what I call the Schirmer neck of our faith. And it's something I think could be more deadly than you ever realize, and most of us are probably sitting in it in some area of our faith, if not our life in general. So today we're calling it Kill Comfort. Everybody say comfort. Everybody say kill it. Killing comfort. And some of you are like, bro, I don't want to kill comfort. I'm trying to get comfort in every area of my life. Like, I don't want to kill comfort, so I'm not going to listen, but I want to talk about this. Killing comfort. Because I went to our key verse of this series where Jesus says, the thief comes only to steal, kill, and destroy, but I have come that you may have life. And then he says this weird phrase, and to have it to the full. So Jesus says, I have come so you can have a full life. Well, what does full mean? Like, what does that actually mean? Is it like full, like I get all the food I want? Like, what's it mean? So I started looking at that, and the real kind of way to understand it is two words, extraordinary or uncommon. Now, uncommon, not as in weird, okay? Uncommon as like, it's abnormally, it's people don't often do this, and it's like extraordinary. It's amazing that someone can do this. And if I were to ask you this, if I said, hey, at the end of your life, when people looked at you, they looked at you and they said, man, that person was extraordinary, or that person was uncommon, how many of you would sign up for that? Most of them are like, I want that, right? Like, I would love that, like extraordinary. You're like, I want an extraordinary marriage. I want an extraordinary business life, career. I want to be an extraordinary parent. I want to be an extraordinary follower of Jesus. Like, we would sign up for that. But what if you said, like, I want to sign up for that, but then you realize this is what it comes with. No life that's extraordinary or uncommon will ever be comfortable. And some of you are like, well, okay, then I don't want it. Nah, no thank you, right? Because you know, to have an extraordinary marriage, that's hard. Marriage is hard at times. It's awesome, but it's hard. It's hard choosing to not pick a fight when I want to pick a fight when I know they're wrong. That's hard, right? She's not in this service, so I can say that. It's hard to put the other person first. Husbands, it's hard to respect your wives, and wives love your husbands at times. That's hard. What about parenting? Want to be an extraordinary parent? Man, that thing's hard, isn't it? What about extraordinary, you know, success in your career? That's hard. Sports, it's hard to have uncommon, extraordinary teams. That's why they don't come around very often. You know, I think back in my life in sports, and every good team I was on, I had a coach who wasn't the best at X's and O's, but had this ability to pull us past our comfort zone. But to have an extraordinary or uncommon life, it's not gonna be comfortable. And in that idea lies tension for you and I. Because how we're hardwired, especially in America, we're hardwired to try to seek comfort in every single capacity of our life. I make fun of my wife all the time. She wears these shoes. I cannot stand them. I know I've talked about it before, but she wears Crocs. Anybody wear Crocs in here? You love them? Okay. And I was like, babe, what are those? Like, why do you wear those? And she's like, they're comfortable. I'm like, hey, they might be comfortable, but they're ugly. Like, I can't get around. Like, they're ugly, right? But they're comfortable. But then I kind of get it, because now I pick out my clothes nowadays, not to be stylish, but I wear what's comfortable. And then you want a comfortable car. You know, as a 16-year-old, I had a Camaro. I wanted it real low with big rims. Now I just want a car I can just fall into. You know what I'm saying? Like, I just want to fall into it with big comfy seats. And then there's something that happened when I turned, you know, got a little older. So maybe some of you will agree with this. If you're under 30, you may not agree with it yet. You might just be like, dude, you're weird. But how about this? A mattress. Come on, so who agrees with that? Like a comfortable mattress, right? And so when Whitney and I got married, we had no money. And so we had a hand-me-down, you know, mattress. I don't even know where it came from. I think it was like Laura Ingalls Wilder, and and it was like so old. And so we would sit in it, and we would just roll to the middle, right? It was just like a V shape. So eventually we got some money. Like, we're gonna buy one of these nice mattresses. You know, we're gonna do it. It came in like a little thing, and it's like, no way, this is a mattress. And you open it up, and like flings you across the room. But then Then I laid on it for the first time, and I'm like, I think I'm sitting on a cloud next to Jesus. Like, it was that comfortable. And now every time I go on vacation, you know, by day 3 or 4, I want to come home to my own bed. I never experienced that in my life. Like, I think, like, I'm an old person now. And then I realized something. Comfort is good to lay in. It's not good to live in. And you might go, well, what does that mean? And I'm not just talking about your faith. I'm talking about every area of your life. There's something called kind of like the comfort zone kind of cycle or trends that we follow. So here's our comfort zone. It's safe. It's low risk. It's like understandable. We know it. And here's where most of us want to get. We want to find purpose. We want to live dreams. We want to set new goals. We want to conquer objectives. And this is where Jesus wants to use us and show us our purpose and stretch us further than we've been stretched and welcome us up into the alive and free life. But here's what happens. To get here, you have to go through all of this. There's the fear zone. Fear zone. You have low confidence. Like, if you have fear, we're going to talk about fear in a couple weeks, but it's find excuses, affected by others' opinions, right? And then there's the learning zone, where you face challenges and you problem solve and you acquire new skills and you extend your comfort zone. But to get to here, to get to alive and free, to get to growth, you have to go through all of this. And this right here brings a lot of discomfort in our lives. And so what happens, we don't even realize this, but we do it. We seek certain things in our life, how we're hardwired, how we live, right? And there's certain comforts we should have. I want a comfortable bed. I want comfortable, I'm going to share this information. I want comfortable toilet paper, right? Like, I want a comfortable car, right? I want financially comfort. I want to have comfort in parenting and our marriages. But there's certain things and certain words we try to strive for in life. And we may not say it, but we all feel it. Certain, we want certainty. Some of you, you need certainty. And you're like, when I don't have certainty, I'm anxious, I'm worried, I'm freaking out. Some of us want just comfortable. Like, I just want to be comfortable, and then we want predictable. And we want these things in certain areas of life. Like I said, these are really good to have. But I wish I could lie to you and tell you that this is what Jesus promised, but he never said this. He never promised there would be certainty in our lives. He never promised it would be comfortable. And my following of Jesus has been anything but predictable. Matter of fact, Jesus is with his disciples one night, and he says he's going to leave. And he's like, don't freak out, because the Spirit's going to come. And the Spirit's going to be a guider, and it's also going to be a what? It's going to be a comforter. It's going to comfort you. We just sang about it. Rest on us, the Spirit of God, rest on us, comfort us. But to have a comforter means what? There are going to be times in your life when you won't have comfort. He promised that. He says there will be times in your life when you're living this journey that I'm calling you on where it will be uncomfortable. Things happen, cancer, sickness, death. You have to go somewhere you don't want to go, right? There are things that make you uncomfortable. He promised this. He actually didn't say, hey, don't worry, life will be easy. He said, no. You will have trouble, but take heart. I've overcome the world, right? Take heart, the Spirit will be with you. Take heart, I'll be with you. And so he says, follow me. And that follow me request or command was the follow me. The call was never comfort. And I'll tell you this, if you follow Jesus long enough and far enough, to live like Jesus is hard. And don't let anybody tell you it's not. It's worth it. It's always worth it. But to die to self is hard. To love other people, to treat other people like they matter, even in my mind they don't. That's hard. To offer the type of forgiveness Jesus calls us to offer is hard. To live and walk in this life in such a way that Jesus calls us to live at times is hard. It's worth it. And the Spirit is with us, guiding us and comforting us. But it often pulls me out of my comfort zone. So here's what's at stake today. Don't trade your calling for comfort. I know it seems comfortable. I know that memory foam mattress life seems really comfortable. But don't trade your calling for that. So don't get comfortable. Don't get comfortable in your sin. Don't get comfortable in your addiction. Don't get comfortable in your anxiety. Don't get comfortable in your anger. Don't get comfortable with what God has done in the past, but be willing to step into your calling each and every day. So what I want to do today is I want to look at a story, a whole account of a girl, a young lady who had to step out of comfort into her calling. And it's a wild story. It's actually the story of Esther. Everybody say Esther. And usually we look at a couple of verses today. We're going to kind of paraphrase an entire book. So yes, I'm going to leave certain things out. This is the NPV version, the Nathan Pelahowski version, right? And so there'll be things we miss, but I'm going to try to give you a great overlook of this book of Esther and this amazing thing that happens. But historically, it's really important to understand when it happens. It happens around a time period of a man named Nehemiah, which was going back to Jerusalem and rebuilding the wall, and Ezra, who was kind of trying to reestablish God's people to follow him again. And so God's people had been brought into exile. They were disobedient, and they didn't listen to God, and bad things happened, right? That's the promise. And bad things happened. Well, God's starting to work and restructure things. And some Jewish people were able to go and were wanting to go back to Jerusalem, but some stayed back in the land under the Persian Empire now. And so Esther was a young orphan girl who's adopted by her cousin who stayed back in a foreign land under a foreign king. And this king that she's under is a little bit wild. So the book of Esther starts, I'm not kidding, with a 180-day party. That's how it starts. It's a massive party, and this is what they say is happening. Drinks were served in gold goblets, many designs, and there was an abundance of royal wine reflecting the king's generosity. By edict of the king, no limits were placed on the drinking, for the king had instructed all his palace officials to serve each and every man as much as he wanted. this is a college, you know, frat party on steroids. It sounds like a Little John song growing up. Like, everybody's drinking, right? Everybody's having fun. Everybody's having a good time. And so they're all drinking. It's 180 days long. Well, a bunch of guys get together and they start drinking. They come up with this great idea. The king's like, hey, you know what? I got a beautiful wife. I want to show her off. And ladies, you're all like, yeah, let's sign up for that. Well, his wife is like, no, not a chance. I'm not coming out to this party. And so you know what happens? You don't tell the king no. So he has her vanish. He replaces her, probably has her whacked, probably kills her. And the rest of his buddies like, hey, we need a new queen now. So they're like, hey, why don't we search the empire to find beautiful young virgins? If you don't know what a virgin is, go ask your parents. I'm not telling that today, all right? Go find a beautiful young virgin for the king. So they gather up all the beautiful women in the city, and they bring her to the king, and they, you know, participate in some extracurricular activities at night. They go through a beautification process. You know, they do what they do, and the king eventually, out of all these beautiful women, will pick the one he likes the most. Sorry, women, if you didn't sign up for this, that's exactly what happened in this time. It was not a great time for women, but this is what happens. And so Esther was one of these women. Unlucky for her, but luckily for her, this is what happens. And the king loved Esther more than any of the young women. And he was so delighted with her that he set the royal crown on her head and declared her queen instead of Vashti, the other queen. So all of a sudden, there's this tension point. God's working. God's working, and he makes this young Jewish girl in a non-Jewish land queen. And she has a cousin named Mordecai. Everybody say Mordecai. Mordecai, it's an important character in the story. Mordecai tells her, hey, Esther, don't tell the king you're Jewish because we're not sure what will happen. Don't tell her. So Esther becomes queen. She's a Jewish queen, and the story starts to unfold. Eventually comes a man on the scene named Haman, and Haman was, no other way to say it, he was a chump. He was a punk. He was a jerk. All those words apply to him, right? Think of the worst person you know. It's probably Haman. And so what he does is he has an ego, but he has a really high power job, a really high ranking job. He's the second in charge to the king. So he's got an ego on him. And what Haman liked is when he walked by people, he wanted everybody to bow. Well, then one day he walks by Mordecai, Esther's cousin, and he's like, I'm not bowing to you. Haman, I'm not bowing to you. Well, Haman gets upset, and he's like, okay, I'm going to have Mordecai killed. And not only am I going to kill Mordecai, I'm going to have every Jewish person killed. So he goes to the king, and the king's kind of this hand-off. I don't think he's a very good king. He's kind of hand-off, and they kind of talk a little bit, and he says, hey, I want to make a decree, and this is what I want to happen. I want to kill all the Jews, right? He says, dispatches were sent by the swift messengers in all the provinces of the empire, giving the order that all Jews, young and old, including women, okay, what was Esther? She was a woman, and children must be killed, slaughtered, and annihilated. I want nothing to do with them. I want them all wiped out on a single day. And this was scheduled to happen on March 7th of the next year. And the property of the Jews would be given to those who killed them. So this is the decree that the king approves. He doesn't quite realize he approves this, but he approves this. Well, Mordecai, Esther's cousin, stick with me here. Esther's cousin gets news of this. Esther's queen, Esther's Jewish, and Mordecai says, we have to do something about this. So Mordecai gave his servant, or Esther's servant, Hatshepsut, a copy of the decree issued in Susa that called for the death of all Jews. And he asked her to show it to Esther and explain the situation to her. He also asked Hatshepsut to direct her to the king to beg for mercy and plead for her people. So they return to Esther with Mordecai's message. So Mordecai sends an Old Testament, you know, text via this servant to Esther and says, listen, Esther, you need to save us. We're all going to be killed. You have to kill comfort, and you have to save us. I know you're living that Gucci life up in the palace like you're queen now, but listen, you're Jewish. You need to save us. Like, we need you to save us. We need you to go before the king to save us. And Esther gets this message, and this is what she says. Well, she's like, well, listen, all the king's officials and even the people in all the provinces know that anyone who appears before the king in his inner court without being invited is doomed to die. Like, if we go to the king uninvited, I'm going to be killed. Unless the king holds out his golden scepter, and the king has not called for me to come to him for 30 days. I haven't even seen him for 30 days. So the servant goes back to Mordecai and gives him that message. Mordecai then responds with like one of these messages, you know, like a little attitude, a little sass. And he goes, hey, don't you think for a moment that because you're in a palace, you'll escape when all the other Jews are killed. Don't you think for a moment because you're comfortable now in a palace that you're not going to be killed like everybody else. And if you keep quiet at a time like this, deliverance and relief for the Jews will arise from some other place, but you and your relatives will die. He's like, don't you think, Esther, because the king has made you queen, he won't kill you. You're Jewish, you forget that? And just because you're comfortable now doesn't mean you won't die. And if you do nothing, we're all going to die. Now, God, he'll deliver us, but you and I will die. And then he says one of my favorite lines you'll find throughout the Bible. And he says, who knows if perhaps you were made queen for just such a time as this? He's like, Esther, do you think this is an accident where you are in life? And that's, maybe he's talking to you. You think it's an accident with the people you're around, the position you're in? Do you think it's an accident you were placed in this palace? He says, God has put you in this palace for his purpose. So I said, you got a choice, my girl. You can choose comfort or you can choose calling. So Esther gets this message, and this is what happens. Though it's against the law, she says, I will go to see the king, and if I must die, I must die. And then it kind of paints this dramatic picture. She goes in front of the king, and everybody's watching, and she opens the big royal doors. Everybody's watching, and she walks up to the king, and now she's walking before the king, and the king has to either hold up his hand or has get her whacked, right? Well, he holds up her hand, and this is what happens next. He said, you can approach me. And the king asked her, what do you want? But he didn't say it like that, right? Okay. But what do you want, Queen Esther? What is your request? I will give it to you, even if it's half the kingdom. And she kind of says, well, I don't have a big request right now, but why don't we just go to dinner? So they have this big royal party. They go to dinner. Then this happens a couple times. And finally, the last dinner, when she says, well, I want everybody invited, all your men. Haman invited, I wanted everybody. And she goes, I have one final request a couple chapters later. I ask that my life and the lives of my people will be spared. I'm Jewish. I'm asking this decree that you have made and have signed. I'm asking for you to spare us. For my people and I have been sold to those who would kill, slaughter, and annihilate us. And if we had merely had been sold as slaves, I could remain quiet, for that would be too trivial a matter to warrant disturbing the king. And the king goes on and says, well, who made this law? He said, what are you talking about? Who made this law? You did. You agreed to it. But it was your main man, Haman, right there. The king gets upset. He kind of is like, how'd you do this to me, Haman? Like, you're trying to fool me? You're trying to turn on me? Like, what's going on? He gets all upset. And then the end of chapter 7, this happens. Or the next couple verses, this happens. So they impaled Haman on the pole he had set up for Mordecai. Pretty cool, right? Like, put him on a human, a human pole, right? Put him on that, right? Can't think of a word here. And the king's anger subsided. A toothpick. He put him on a human toothpick. Thank you. All right? So they impaled Haman on the pole he had set up for Mordecai. Mordecai dies. And as a result, guess what happens? All these Jewish people are saved. And thousands of years later, in 2024, we're talking about a young, orphan Jewish girl who became queen. And you're thinking, that's a really cool story, dude. But so what? That's what you're thinking. Why does it matter to me? That's the question, right? Why does any of this matter to me? What's so cool about the book of Esther is God's name's not mentioned one time in the book. There's no major miracle in the book besides God saving, working through Esther. But God's name's not mentioned one time. There's only one other book in the entire Bible where God's name's not mentioned one time, and this is one of them. But you see, if you read it from beginning to end, which I encourage you to do, you see God working it throughout the whole time. That his fingerprints are all over this book. You may not see it, but God's fingerprints are all over your life. And he's working when you may not feel it, you may not realize it, you may not want him to, but God is working. And he's calling you to something, and he's working, and he's moving, and he's making things happen in your life, just like Esther's life. And the great tragedy of our lives is that when God calls us to move or God tries to do something, and that we get our own way because of comfort, because of fear, because of anxiety, because of a list of things. But when I see the story of Esther, I see so much more than just a history book. I see a young girl who's willing to kill her comfort to step into her calling. So how this hits you and me is that we have to kill comfort to step into our calling. And to kill your comfort to step into your calling. And here's what I believe, and I've said it 1,000 times, but I believe that God has a purpose for your life. I believe that God has a plan for your life. I believe he has a calling on your life. And I believe there are certain things that God has called you to do, and only you to do, for certain reasons and certain times. And so often we miss it, and God will make things happen still, but so often we miss the alive and free life that God has for us because we're comfortable, because we want predictable, we want comfortability. We want to know what's going to happen. We want certainty. But God's saying, I'm just calling you to step. I'm calling you to step out of your comfort and into your calling. Esther, that is the story of Esther. She was comfortable in a palace. And her cousin comes to her and says, hey, yo, we need you to move. Do something to save us. And she moved. And I love this quote. It says, you have no idea what our God can set into motion through one single act of obedience. We have no idea what God will do in your life through your yes. How many of you, if you be open and vulnerable for a second, how many of you came from a broken home? Raise your hand. And how many of you said, you know, I don't want my future to be the same as my past, my family tree? Anybody? Right? That's something we have so in common. You never know what's on the other side of your yes to God when it comes to your family tree. You never know how you saying yes to God, being obedient to God in certain areas of your life can change your family history. Take it from my life. I had no idea that when I said yes to Jesus all those years ago, how my family tree would move through that one single act of obedience. You have no idea how your yes or your obedience to God in your marriage can change your complete marriage. You have no idea how it can change your parenting. And here's what's awesome. Esther had no idea what her yes would do for a whole generation of people. And sometimes we get so focused and thinking our calling's just for us. And I don't believe that. I don't believe that God gives us our talents, our abilities, our life just for us. But he gives it for us to make a difference in the world, for his kingdom, and impact the people around us. So we never know what or who hangs in the balance of our obedience. And you have no idea what God can do through one single act of obedience, of being uncomfortable. And another thing I love about Esther, she doesn't have this resume of amazingness. Esther was an ordinary woman with an extraordinary ability to kill comfort. And you may have come here today and says, man, I am as ordinary as they come. I'm vanilla, baby, right? You might have come in here saying that today. You say, I have no skills, I have no talents, I have nothing to offer. And God says something else. Here's what I believe about your life, that God has placed you in a palace. And some of you are like, hey, dude, you must never have seen my house, right? Like, it's not a palace, right? Maybe that's not your palace. Maybe your palace is your cubicle. Maybe it's with your kids. And what better palace to be in, right? Maybe it's with the talents you have. Maybe it's in your classroom. Maybe it's the sports team you're coaching. Maybe it's in your marriage. Maybe it's at your work. Maybe it's playing pickleball. Maybe it's at the gym. But God's placed you in a palace. And you may say, I don't have enough. Let's listen to what Esther had. Beauty, a position, a palace, an ability to kill comfort. Some of you might not have beauty, but you got some, right? You got some talents. You got some abilities. And you got a palace. And your history doesn't matter in that palace. Your abilities doesn't matter in that palace. When God calls you to that palace, you know what matters most? Your availability and your ability to kill comfort in your life. That's what matters. That's the qualifications. We all could do that. But faith is hard. In this journey of following Jesus' heart, I often refer to it as a steering wheel. Now, I put a Ferrari up here because your boy can dream a little bit, can he, right? But you know, when I think about a steering wheel, when I'm behind the wheel, I feel really comfortable. Anybody else? Like, hey, you know, I'm a pretty good driver. I feel like I'm a good driver. And when we're going somewhere, I want to drive, right? So, because I know my ability, I'm trusting it, right? I know where I'm going. The second I get in the passenger seat or the back seat, I get really uncomfortable, right? Because you're thinking, brake, 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 brake. Like, bro, have you ever driven before, right? Or merge, like, watch out, right? You start freaking out a little bit. Faith's a lot like that. Carrie Underwood said a long time ago, you know, Jesus, take the wheel. That's a lot like faith. Faith is this. It's handing over the steering wheel. And it's a little uncomfortable. Because when you're behind the steering wheel, you got all the control and all the power, don't you? And all of a sudden, Jesus is driving, and you want him to go real fast, and he's going real slow during certain times of life. He's just cruising the streets, right? And then there's certain areas in life, and he's like, hey, let's just fly right through that part of that neighborhood. And Jesus is like, no, we're going to stop here and chill for a little bit. And there's times in life when you want to take a right, and he's like, no, we're going to take a left. There's times you want to go forward, and there's times you want to go back, and Jesus is in control. And so faith is handing over that wheel to Jesus. But here comes the hard part. We said, Jesus, take the wheel. And all of a sudden, he stops where we don't want to stop. You're like, whoa, 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 give me back the wheel. It's like letting your teenager drive for the first time. Give me back the wheel. Like, we're not doing this. Have somebody else do this. Give me the wheel. We're going to go right through here. And hey, Jesus is going to turn here. Like, no. Give me that wheel. I'm going to take it back here. And so we get in this tugging war match. Taking the wheel, giving the wheel. Taking the wheel, giving the wheel. And that's faith for so many of us. And here's what you realize. If you start looking at the times you take the wheel and you give the wheel, you would realize this with, I would predict great certainty, that almost every time you're tempted to take the wheel is every time you're uncomfortable, right? Every time you start to be at a place you don't want to be at. Every time you're in a season of life you don't want. Every time things aren't going the way you thought they should, you start taking that wheel back. But Jesus says, I want to give you the live and free life. I want to give you a life that's full, that's extraordinary, that's uncommon. And he doesn't say, you're going to drive to get there. He's like, no. I'm going to drive to get there. I know the way. So the question we all have to answer in our lives are you willing to give up your comfort and hand over the wheel? Are you willing to get uncomfortable and say, God, I don't know where you're going to send me. I don't know what you want me to do. I don't know if I have the skill set. I don't know if I have the abilities. I don't know if I have the strength. I don't know if I have what it takes. But if you say go, I'll go. If you say accelerate, I'll accelerate. If you say break, I'll break. If you say leave this part of town, baby, I'll leave tomorrow, right? Like, I'm doing whatever you want me to do. There's a man named Paul who had amazing success spreading the gospel. And he had an amazing, like, past. He says, brothers and sisters, I have not achieved it. But I focused on this. He said, I haven't achieved this contentment, this thing I'm seeking, but I focus on this one thing, forgetting the past and looking forward to what lies ahead. This is what I'm focusing on. I'm forgetting the past and I'm focusing what's ahead. And I press on. Everybody say it, press on. Press on to reach the end of the race and receive the heavenly prize for which God, through Christ Jesus, is calling us. He said, I press on. And a lot of times we look at this idea of pressing on as we think, I'm pressing on from all the bad things in life. And that's part of it. But it's also pressing on from our comfort zone. He goes, I focus on this one thing and I'm focused ahead. I'm not focused over here. I'm focused on ahead and that prize that Jesus is calling me to, that God's calling me to. I'm focused on that alive and free life. I'm just focused ahead. And you start to read this, you realize that I can press on and move forward or stay where you are. Those are your two options. And if you stay where you are, you're not going to grow. You're probably going to move further, further back. But I can press on and get uncomfortable, or I can be comfortable and stay where I am. And so many areas of your life, if I said, if you could just press on, there's something better in front of you, you would sign up. But sometimes when it comes to this faith and that steering wheel, it's so hard just to press on. But he says, if I press on, I'll get to the prize. So here's what we have to do. We have to kill comfort and step into your calling. God has a calling, God has a purpose, God has a plan. Don't stay in your comfort zone and miss what he's trying to do. He says, I have a life that's extraordinary and uncommon for you, but it's pressing on to reaching in every season of life. This is what's so hard. At every season of life, it's pressing on to what's next that God has for you and your purpose and calling. Not in your marriage, not in other areas, right? But I'm talking about in your faith life. It's good to be content in other areas, but in your faith life, God wants to continually work in you, continually stretch you, continue to bring you somewhere. So I press on and I focus ahead. In your marriages, in your relationships, in your work, in your finances, God wants to do something amazing. Your life changes when God gets involved in the story. And maybe you feel like you have no purpose, have no meaning. God says, I say otherwise. And I don't know where you're at right now. I don't know what's going on. And maybe you look around and say, man, it's a mess out there. My life's a mess. The world's a mess. Somebody needs to do something. Well, who knows? Maybe you and I were created for such a time as this. Let's pray. God, we're so thankful for who you are. We're so thankful that you have a calling and a purpose and a plan for our lives, even when we don't see it, God. And we want to thank you for what you've done. But God, we're going to ask a big, big prayer that you pull us further and further into the life you have for us, that we never settle for the comfort zone, that we settle to strive to be an alive and free life. God, I know that with the people in this room, you have such big plans, that we were created for such a time as this, in a palace just like this, for a purpose that you have. Let us never miss it, and let us learn to kill comfort, to step into the alive and free life. In your name we pray. Amen.